Good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds, the associate producer of the Roundtable on WAMC. Each weekday morning, the Roundtable's Joe Donahue is joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review, we feature selections from this week's shows. On Wednesday, November 13th, Joe was joined by Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Robert Griffin, Senior Fellow at Bard's Center for Civic Engagement, Ambassador Fred Hoff, and Albany Law School Professor and Director of the Justice Center, Sarah Rogerson.
Trump has picked Pete Hegseth, a veteran who has absolutely no experience in the federal government or that. Mm. But he was a Fox News host, and he hosted not even the daily program, but he was a weekend anchor, and nothing against weekend anchors, for goodness sakes. But Fox News host Pete Hegseth has been named defense secretary. The choice of Mr. Hegseth, a dedicated supporter of the president-elect in his first term, was outside the norm, according to this coverage in the New York Times, outside the norm for a traditional choice of the post. And you probably didn't need me to say that. He is a veteran of the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. He will now go on to run the Pentagon and lead 1.3 million active duty troops.
If confirmed.
The choice of Mr. Hegseth was outside the norm, but he was a dedicated supporter. And defending his actions, Mr. Trump's actions with the North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, embracing his America First agenda and trying to withdraw U.S. troops from abroad and energetically taking up the cause of combat veterans accused of war crimes. In a statement announcing his pick, Mr. Trump praised Mr. Hegseth's combat experience and support of the military and veterans. Pete is tough, smart, and a true believer in America First. Mr. Hegseth is a co-host of Fox and Friends. He joined the network as a contributor in 2014 and has been the host of Fox's New Year's coverage for years. So, what do you make of this, Ambassador Hoff?
Well, I am indeed going to do my best to be kind in the face of this news, but it's a bit of a challenge. Look, the Department of Defense is a huge organization. It's got a budget that over the next 4 years is probably going to hit $1 trillion. It's got nearly 3 million people, uniformed and civilian, on the rolls. It faces tremendous challenges in rebuilding our defense industrial base and acquiring the capabilities to deter and, if necessary, defeat Chinese aggression. You know, now President Trump is fully entitled to nominate a supporter to this important post. And the fact that Mr. Hegseth is an Army veteran of Iraq and Afghanistan does indeed count in his favor. But his lack of objective qualifications for the job, never having been in charge of a large, complex organization, never having had a senior position in government or close to government on national security affairs, this is going to present the U.S. Senate, in my opinion, with a real confirmation challenge. We can probably assume that 47 Democrats, if that's the final number, will vote no. But there may also be a handful of Republicans simply unable to support the president on this nomination. But if he is confirmed, his choice for Deputy Secretary of Defense will be absolutely critical, because somebody actually has to run this department. And even if there is a qualified and competent Deputy Secretary of Defense, it's the Secretary himself. who must advise the president on matters of war and peace. And I'm honestly just not sure that this guy is in a position to do that.
What do you think the rationale is, in the sense of the president-elect to say, this guy should be our Secretary of Defense?
I don't know that we can really come up with a rationale here that reflects a lot of deliberation on the part of the president. Part of what's going on here is that others who were considered for this position and who are objectively more qualified, Senator Cotton of Arkansas, former Secretary of State, former CIA Director Mike Pompeo, they turned it down. Congressman Mike Waltz was considered a possible SecDef.
I'm sorry,
but he's going to be National Security Advisor instead.
I don't think Pompeo was invited to the party, right?
No, he's not. He was eliminated from the party, right. But that's one of the reasons why there is one fewer possibility to fill this post.
Yeah.
Well, some of it, they know what Trump wants to do, and that's part of the problem. They know they have to work for him. So this is a guy that will work for him. I mean, this guy, this is just from his Wikipedia page, but reportedly persuaded Trump to pardon three American soldiers accused or convicted of war crimes relating to the shooting of noncombatants in Iraq. And for his service record, he was a platoon leader at Guantanamo Bay and defended the treatment of inmates detained there. So we're going all in on war criminals. And that's what they want to be in that gray area, that flexible zone of international norms regarding the law of war. And that's exactly where Trump wants to be.
So then if I'm reading you correctly, that is then a more thoughtful approach as to what they want.
Maybe aligned. I don't know about thoughtful because of the credential problems. But right. He served in a number of posts. And, you know, he was...
And he helped us ring in the new year.
Some of us. I wasn't watching. But also he was at the Manhattan Institute, right? So again, it's the ideology. And if we think of the figureheads that Trump is installing or attempting to install, that's the point. The point is the message, because they know that in the grand scheme of things, a couple of years is a very short period of time to actually get the big picture things done.
Robert.
I mean, I think it comes down to loyalty. I mean, it's who is not going to stand up to Trump? It's not a question of having somebody who's going to provide good and honest advice and counsel. It's going to be who's going to do whatever Donald wants. I mean, this whole cabinet, I call it the orange jumpsuit cabinet. I think over time, you know, it'd be interesting to track how many of the folks.
Not a kind thing to say.
Just true to my word. It also explains why Trump is pushing the Senate to give up on their constitutional authorities and allow for recess appointments, because he knows that some of these choices are so bad. Think about a choice for the single most important cabinet position, in my mind, is the Secretary of Defense. And the choice is so bad that even his lapdogs in the Senate are barking. I mean, and again, you know, only Donald could make such a poor decision. The feckless GOP senators are already balking. And this is on top of a couple of other choices that people are going, wow, you know, this is crazy Trump. Back to Fred's comments, the Secretary of Defense runs a huge bureaucracy, but is also, at least in my mind, is on par with the Secretary of State as far as the advancement of our international diplomacy efforts, whether we like it or not. And I mean, this is where American strength and power comes from. This is where our industrial might it shows itself. And you're putting a platoon sergeant in charge of this really...
No, he was a platoon leader. He was actually a lieutenant.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Did I say sergeant? I didn't mean to insult
the... That's very unkind.
The enlisted leadership.
I was amused that as you were saying most of that, you were holding your head.
Yeah. No, I mean, for the last week, I've been holding my head a lot. It's
You know, I am a glass half full guy. And to know that someday that it's a possibility.
Joe, that's not beer. Just
that,
letting
that
you know.
As a talk show host, I could go on and become Secretary of Defense. That's pretty good. The possibility exists.
Yeah. And the fact that he makes Tom Cotton look like a more viable choice just says so much to me about this choice.
Okay. So we're going to take a break in just a minute. But you talked about recess appointments. Is there any chance that won't happen?
I think this is the first big test of how strong the Constitution is going to be, because if the GOP Senate gives him recess appointment, then I think it's a sign pretty much that whatever he wants is going to happen.
Yeah, I think if Senator Scott of Florida emerges as the majority leader, there is probably a 50-50 chance that this could be done. And what is unique, I mean, recess appointments have been made down through time by administrations. What is unique in this one, in essence, is that President Trump is asking the Senate to do a minimum of a 10-day recess early, so he can appoint people who would be serving for the rest of the Senate's term.
And remember, Hegseth, too, was floated for the head of the Veterans Administration.
Yes, right.
And his views on privatization, the level of care for veterans, was so controversial that it was a non-starter.
Right. Let's get to some of the letters. James writes, "It's troubling to me that democratic values are increasingly couched as being the purview of elites. Even Democrats are participating in this brand of Orwellian doublespeak. Is there a way for Democrats to engage in post-election self-analysis without compromising their deeply held values? Republicans have no problem sticking to their core principles, that voters be damned." All right.
Well, it is interesting that
I'll make
this,
that rhetorical.
That this defense secretary nominee went to Princeton undergrad and then Harvard graduate school.
Yeah.
So, like,
yes,
not that that's a bad thing. It's just, you know, they kind of ran on.
It's not non-elite.
Right.
Yeah. Yes.
But we've said on the show before, both Harvard and Yale Law, I think, have done a remarkable job in screwing this country up. And I don't think that they're held accountable for that as much as they should, especially if you look at the makeup of the Supreme Court.
Terry Gibson, we're sorry. Okay.
Well, but Terry's not responsible for either Harvard or Yale Law.
No, absolutely.
But there is this lock. I mean, there is this seemingly lock on these key positions, which is, you know, I've said before. I really do think that there's a significant challenge of class in this country that is going to come back and bite us on the rear end at some point in time.
Let's go to this letter from T, who says, "Would like to hear you discuss the scheme to avoid pesky Senate confirmation hearings by making recess appointments. In that case, no need to worry about qualifications." Well, we talked about that before the break, a preview of this administration's contempt for the Constitution. So
yeah,
we gave it a 50-50. Right?
Yeah, there is a clause in the Constitution covering this. I actually looked it up this morning. It's Article 2, Section 2, Clause 3. It's very brief. It says the president shall have power to fill up all vacancies that may happen during the recess of the Senate by granting commissions which shall expire at the end of their next session. When the Constitution was put together, people traveled by carriage. When the Senate went on recess, it would take days and weeks to reconvene it. And this is why the president was given the power to make these sort of interim appointments if an office went vacant. It's been used much more often in recent years, and what President Trump basically wants to do is have the United States Senate declare a recess very early after convening in 2025 so that he can go ahead and make appointments that will last into 2026.
Matt writes, one of the most well-known failings of the first Trump administration was the lack of preparedness and the overvaluation of loyalty above all else. The cabinet picks so far, the second time around, represent a doubling down on that failure from the first term. Essentially, with Trump, his belief that everything begins and ends with him alone, the cabinet picks indicate that he is, in essence, nominating himself for all of the posts, and by draining the House and Senate to fill his cabinet, he's really tripling down on the failure. Well, you go right on ahead, Mr. Trump. We will enjoy watching the failure for a second time, writes Matt.
I think Matt has a good point. And look, Donald Trump won this election. He has the absolute right to nominate people who are loyal to him, who believe in his policy priorities. But as chief executive, as commander in chief, he owes it to himself to appoint qualified people who can push back when necessary, who can help inform decisions, and the fact that he doesn't seem to be looking for that is potentially very troubling.
But again, none of this should come as any surprise. I mean, this is what he said. I mean, this is all part of the 2025 playbook. I mean, we sit here and sort of, you know, shake our heads at it, but this is completely in keeping. And again, he's going to do to the country what he's done through his entire business career. He's going to run it into the ground, and then he'll walk away. And you know, I don't, you know, we'll see what kind of messes is around at the end. The other thing too is that, you know, if you think about the recess appointments, it gives him an opportunity to really put into place. There are people out there that are even more incompetent and vile than some of the people that he has already named. And if he gets the right to do a recess appointment, and if the Senate, you know, bends to his wishes, it's going to these conversations are minor compared to what I think will happen.
We are just a reminder that President Biden will be meeting with President-elect Trump this morning. Trump just landed in D.C. and is on his way to the White House now, and is expected to be meeting with Biden as well as GOP leaders. We go back to the letters. Kenneth writes, what does this appointment of a platoon leader mean to all the senior military leaders in the Department of Defense? Will we begin to see early retirements of ranking admirals, generals, and other important military leaders?
I would think the opposite. I may be speaking out of turn, but I think anybody who I know people in high-ranking positions in the United States military, and they swore an oath, and they will keep it.
Yeah, and I, you know, to be honest with you, this fellow, having been a platoon leader, really doesn't count against him. I mean, John F. Kennedy commanded a patrol boat. Abraham Lincoln was briefly a member of a militia. You know, one doesn't have to be a general, as we've had for the last 4 years as Secretary of Defense. But ideally, you would nominate to this position somebody steeped in national security affairs and somebody who has had some experience running a large and complex organization. And we clearly don't have that here.
That was Fred Hoff on the Roundtable panel on Wednesday, November 13th. We'll be back with more after this break. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. On Thursday, November 14th, Joe was joined by an advance lead for the White House and former chief of staff for State Senator Michelle Hinchey and former assistant county executive for Pat Ryan, Anna Markowitz, vice president for editorial development at the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick, and Wall Street investment banker Mark Whitman.
Here's the deal. Yesterday, let me just set the stage here for a moment. Yesterday, while we were on the air, President-elect Trump flew from Mar-a-Lago in Florida to Washington, D.C. to meet with current President Joe Biden to discuss the peaceful transfer of power. They had a meeting that was expected to be somewhere between a half hour and an hour. It ended up being nearly 2 hours long. By all accounts, and there were only, I believe, four people in the room, Trump, Biden, and their chiefs of staff. But by all accounts, and according to both the president-elect and the current president and his spokesperson, it was a very cordial meeting. It was a very lengthy meeting and actually policy and detail-oriented. And that was the story that was coming out around noontime. The president-elect then, prior to that, had spoken to GOP leaders as well, and then got on the plane and went back to Mar-a-Lago. Then we started. That's when the fun started, and we got the nominations. First of all, we had been talking about Marco Rubio, Secretary of State, for several days. That was reported over the weekend, I believe, first by CNN, and then other news organizations also confirmed it. And at that point, there was no official announcement. So some were wondering as to what that meant, because there were other official announcements that went out in regards to the other picks. So the president-elect put out a press release and said that Marco Rubio is my pick for Secretary of State. Then next up on the hit parade was Tulsi Gabbard for Tulsi Gabbard was a Democrat. She was from the state of Hawaii. And then switched parties and was a very outspoken praiser of the then former president, now president-elect. And Tulsi Gabbard is expected to become the Director of National Intelligence. DNI is what it is known as. Has been a longtime critic of foreign policy establishment, and now will serve as the Director of National Intelligence. Ms. Gabbard was a lieutenant colonel in the Army Reserve who served in Iraq, has been a longtime critic of the foreign policy establishment. Her nomination, another sign that Mr. Trump intends to give top foreign policy jobs to supporters who are deeply skeptical of the effectiveness of U.S. military intervention. And then, as if right on time, in prime time, ready for the big event, was the announcement that Matt Gaetz, a bomb thrower, if there ever was one, a man who has been credited or discredited for almost single-handedly taking away the speakership of one Kevin McCarthy. Ask Kevin McCarthy about it. He has a lot to say on the subject. He is a Florida congressman, was, and he has been chosen to be attorney general. And this is an attack dog. It's hard to think of somebody, anyone else, as describing him as anything else, to preside over the Department of Justice. He is 42 years old. He is a Florida Republican. He was investigated by the Justice Department on suspicion of child sex trafficking. This year, after the government case was shuttered, the House Committee on Ethics opened its own inquiry into the matter, which effectively ended on Wednesday night after Mr. Gaetz resigned from his seat. Mr. Gaetz has been accused of showing photos of nude women to colleagues on the House floor and seeking a pardon from the previous Trump White House. He has denied each of those allegations. There were sex trafficking and having sex with a minor, as well as random drug charges that were a part of that initial investigation. Mr. Gaetz is an avowed enemy of virtually every top Republican not named Trump. He led the charge last year to oust one Republican leader, Speaker Kevin McCarthy, and this year openly celebrated the resignations of two others, Mitch McConnell, who announced he would be retiring as minority leader, and Ronna McDaniel, who stepped down as chairwoman of the Republican Party National Committee. We've now 86th McCarthy, McDaniel, McConnell, Mr. Gaetz exalted on the social media platform X in March. I'm not some Lord of the Flies nihilist, Gaetz insisted to the New York Times in January, just after he had relinquished his 5-day blockade of Mr. McCarthy's eventually successful quest to be speaker. But 9 months later, Mr. Gaetz helped push Mr. McCarthy out of the job for good. That it was in January of 2023. Even Mr. Gaetz's many detractors ruefully acknowledge the tactical acumen of Mr. Gaetz, a former high school debate champion and commercial litigation attorney. Shortly after being elected to the House in 2016, he successfully worked the of the steering committee, and in a rarity for a freshman, landed plum assignments on both the Armed Services and Judiciary Committees.
Where do you even start? I mean, the fact that you have someone who is currently under investigation for child sex trafficking leading the Department of Justice. I mean, it is just, it's like a farce. It's like, yeah. So there's that. Feeling great. And then Tulsi Gabbard, she is a favorite of Russia and is going to be in charge of intelligence. Like, can we please look into this? Is this all legal?
Well, and then so the big question overlying all of this, I think, is two questions. One, I think in the brightest of interpretations is that some of these have been thrown out as red meat, so that some of the less outrageous nominations can go through the process. But then that brings up the question of what's the process? Are we going to have a traditional process of being confirmed, or is it going to be by recess appointment, in which case anybody that President-elect Trump wants can get into those positions? So then that brings that to the fore. So it is like setting it up as to, well, we're not talking about Hegseth anymore, are we? Which is what we were doing yesterday and the day before. Mark.
Yeah, actually, Joe, I think that you can bring a lot of sense to this, and I think you have to look at initially the first Trump administration where Trump and his team were the dog that caught the car. They weren't ready. Pence and his group stepped in and provided a lot of the appointments who were eventually confirmed to the cabinet and similarly senior positions. There were some in the mega world that made their way in, and the two, sort of the Reagan camp, Pence camp, and the mega camp battled it out and each notched wins. But even within the mega camp, if you remember at the time, people said that Trump was a moderate within the mega movement. Well, this time, the full-on mega movement has got the reins. And this is very intentional. It's clear, as you say, that Trump is trying to sort of swarm the Senate, right? He's trying to send in so many appointments that are unfit. There are at least three on the docket now. That given Senate norms, even when they do reject these things, the Senate is a political body that tends to, quote unquote, compromise. So what do you do if the other side just keeps sending you unsuitable after unsuitable appointment? How many times do you say no, and does the bar move as a result of this? The other thing is, it's not an accident that for institutions like the State Department, where the president necessarily calls the shots, he's got the whip hand with respect to the State Department, Trump appointed Rubio. But with respect to departments that have their own institutional momentum, justice and defense, Trump appoints pure loyalists without regard to experience or qualifications. And if you remember last time, he Trump, had particularly expressed his discontent with Jeff Sessions. I think he said Jeff Sessions was subject to Stockholm Syndrome, was his comment at one point. And he obviously, we know what he thinks of defense generals and what he wants from them. Do you want to take a pause?
No, I want you to keep going.
Oh, okay. So I don't think, if you look at how he's organized these appointments in terms of the swarming effect, in terms of the asking for the recess appointments, and in terms of where he's put the sort of all-out loyalists, I don't think this is all a accident in any means. And, you know, frankly, for the Senate, by the way, the Senate deserves this. These people, this body was 10 votes away from, I mean this metaphorically, putting a stake in the heart of this man politically, this man being Trump. They could have ended it. I love the fact that Mitch McConnell is now lashed to the tree watching us all this happen in a body that he thought he once revered. Because they've got to make tough decisions, and they should learn their lesson, and America needs to learn this lesson. If you don't take care of this now, in other words, you start moving the bar and let some of these folks, unsuitable folks in, this will come back to bite the institution of the United States, institutions broadly in the United States, but it'll also come back to bite the Senate. You should have taken your medicine up front when you had a chance to impeach the man. You didn't. The chickens are home to roost. You better deal with them now. And that's also a lesson for U.S. foreign policy on trade or on our military force that we ought to keep in the back of our mind as we deal with these, you know, super isolationists that are part of the mega movement.
So stop me if you've heard this one before, but it is that the many Republicans who are out there talking about these appointments are saying, look, here's a guy. President-elect Trump, he won. He won with a majority. He has a mandate. And this is the line, and he deserves to have the cabinet that he wants. This is what we voted for. Judy Patrick.
So the U.S. Constitution does give the Senate the advice and consent authority. So they need to exercise it. It's supposed to be, you know, different branches of government. They need to step up. We'll see whether or not this is a true test of the Senate, of whether or not the Senate as an institution will survive. I can only imagine that Matt Gaetz can get approved through a recess appointment. I mean, Donald Trump is flooding the zone with news. This is what he did during his entire presidency. There are so much news every day, we can't focus on anything correctly or sufficiently for the public to understand what's going on. And it's a classic move. And I think he's positioning, maybe I'll get the Rubio does seem normal, right? I mean, Rubio of 2016 is a different guy than the Rubio of 2024.
Right.
So so if you throw out the Gaetzes, I mean, he could be a recess appointment. He'll only be there for 2 years, but that's all Trump needs. Also, keep in mind that all these people are going to be gone. Nobody's going to stay long, especially if you're trying to get in the limelight. I don't think Elon Musk is long for the Trump administration. He's getting too much attention, and Trump hates that. All these people look good on TV. I tend to think of the presidential appointments as puppets of the president. I agree with Mark about Secretary of State. That is something different. But I was prepared not to get hysterical over every single appointment. But Matt Gaetz is absurd. We will see. It's a true test of the Senate. They're a bunch of old white men, though. We'll see what they do.
You know, institutions that work well constrain even the actors within that institution. And Donald Trump is president because people restrained him during his first administration. And the most stark example of that is when he wasn't allowed to drive the beast up to the Capitol on January 6th and personally get physically involved in the altercation. Somebody in the Secret Service, who technically isn't his boss, he's the president, said, no, there are institutional constraints here. This is a bad Shakespearean tragedy. It's going to end badly. The question is, how much carnage do we have to see before it ends? And the Senate has a chance to at least constrain it, constrain the damage that we see before we get to the fifth act. And I hope they do what they ought. It's going to be gruesome to watch.
But you are hearing loyalists and people who have already been chosen for key cabinet positions say things like, Matt Gaetz is the most qualified person ever for the office of Attorney General. And I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm just saying that I think it's going to take a while for that body as a whole to come around to a point where they are not saying, oh, that seems unfortunate.
Yeah, I think that they are going to appoint a lot of these people. I wish I didn't think that, but, you know, I think people fall in line and they do what they're supposed to do when, you know, and I think that they see it as this is the movement. This is the time. I wish it wasn't what I thought.
I mean, you have Lisa Murkowski, you have Susan Collins, and remember when we go back to counting on their votes, and who have both come out and said that they didn't think that this was appropriate. You have the possibility of Mitch McConnell not going for it, but then so there's your three.
Well, you've got Kat Cassidy, who also voted to impeach Trump, is still there, and then you've got Tillis, who's, you know, given the nature of his state, is probably more likely to behave than some others.
And then you have J.D. Vance, who's going to, you know, cast the deciding vote in the Senate for the confirmation. Mm-hmm. So I don't know necessarily if the numbers. Now, the other thing I want to talk about, we're going to take a break, but the other thing that I find really interesting about this is, here again, Matt Gaetz, a member of Congress who
former.
Has been taken
former gone.
Well, right, but gone. But, you know, we're still playing with the majority. It's razor thin. And not that I think that seat is going to go Democratic, but I think it will be interesting to see what the makeup of the Congress is, because this is still, they're playing with a very, very slim margin in both houses.
I had heard last night that Elon Musk and his crew were putting pressure on DeSantis to line up
Laura Trump
in this for the Senate seat should Rubio ultimately be appointed to. I mean, the machinations here are mind-numbing.
That was Mark Whitman on the Roundtable panel on Thursday, November 14th. We'll be back with more of the Roundtable panel The Week in Review after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel of the Week in Review. On Friday, November 15th, Joe was joined by Chief of Staff and Vice President for Strategy and Policy at Bard College, Malia Dumont, the Ulster County Comptroller and the former President and CEO of the Community Foundations of the Hudson Valley, March Gallagher, and Siena College Professor of Economics, Aaron Pasitti. We are also joined by Siena College Economics majors from the Federal Reserve Challenge Course, Bobby Tuig, Casey Owens, Jade O'Connell, and Ethan Tate.
Yesterday, we knew this. I think we knew this one was coming, but still, it's a big one, and that is that the president-elect of the United States, Donald Trump, has named Robert F. Kennedy Jr. to lead HHS, which is Health and Human Services. And it is a $2 trillion, with a T, trillion-dollar agency that administers health insurance programs for millions of Americans, approves medications, and oversees vaccine safety. Fun little asterisk. RFK isn't a great fan of vaccines. But here is a guy who suspended his own bid for president in hopes of winning a spot in the Trump administration and has pledged fighting chronic disease his signature cause. The DHS is a sprawling agency responsible for administering millions of Americans' health insurance, approving drugs and medical supplies, regulating food, and responding to infectious disease outbreaks. The decision, which public health experts and many Democrats characterized as alarming and unprecedented, means that one of America's most prominent vaccine skeptics could soon oversee an agency responsible for the safety of vaccines. Kennedy did not immediately reply to comment for comment on this. Kennedy, as a founder of a major anti-vaccine group, has long criticized the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's recommended list of childhood immunizations, promoting debunked claims about vaccines links to autism. He has argued that federal agencies have not done enough research on the shots that hundreds of millions of Americans have received to protect them from measles, flu, and other infectious disease. His claims are rejected by health officials who say that vaccines have been thoroughly studied and are responsible for ending threats such as polio in the United States of America. We have nominated people for the job we disagreed with on policy and ideology, but I'm unaware of anyone who's been nominated for this job that we can't trust what they say. Those words come from George Benjamin, longtime executive director of the American Public Health Association. Mandy Cohen, the CDC's director, said she was concerned by Kennedy's selection. Cohen wrote in a text message, "I don't want to go backwards and see children or adults suffer or lose their lives to remind us that vaccines work." All right. A lot of questions here. One, of course, is just the overall pick. And then, of course, the bigger question of whether confirmation can actually happen and how that process will go. And that can be said for many of the picks, especially the more controversial ones that have come out in the past several days. March Gallagher, I'll let you start us off.
All right. Thanks, Joe. So, you know, Kennedy has said some things that are actually make sense from a public health perspective, right? He wants to eliminate pharma ads, that is medication advertisements to the public, processed food. He's saying he won't take away vaccines. But when you take that and compare it in sort of a weighted scale against the massive amounts of misinformation he's put out, it's very troubling to see his nomination move forward. And I also have to look at somebody like him with this really storied career history. I mean, this is somebody who has a long resume, and a resume that has a lot of good work on it, particularly, you know, in the middle of his career. You know, he was litigating on behalf of people right here in the Hudson Valley against, for example, GE's toxic dumping in the Hudson River. You know, he worked for Riverkeeper, he worked for NRDC. So it makes me wonder what happens to people that makes them
change like this. And now I'm going to just move on to some of the really weird things he said. HIV does not result in AIDS, that COVID was sparing, you know, Jewish people and Chinese people, that the CIA was involved in the JFK assassination, you know, just things that to me sound off the wall. And then I'm going to just, you know, summarize at the end of this comment by saying this, you know, Health and Human Services has a tremendous impact on Ulster County, on the county that I'm the comptroller for. It's $25.6 million in federal expenditures that we do each year. That's HHS funds. That's federal money. And it touches things that you may not realize. It's not just sort of like vaccine programs, right? It also includes things like temporary assistance to needy families. So is Kennedy going to push back against Trump when there are, you know, cuts requested to areas that really are creating health for the population, like TANF dollars, temporary assistance for needy families? Or is he going to just toe the line? We don't know.
Malia DeMunt.
So, yes, a lot of things to be concerned about with this nomination. Hope is not a strategy, but nonetheless, I have some hope that not all is lost if the nomination goes through. Of course, that's a big question. Will the nomination be approved? It's an enormous agency with a lot to keep him busy. So unless he intends to focus 100% of his time on vaccines, you know, I don't think we're going to see, if he makes it through again, negative results in that area right away. He did say in his last big speech before he gave up his presidential campaign, he does have some things in mind, some priorities that I think a lot of us can be on board with. He's really concerned, and this ties to what March was talking about with his background as an environmental lawyer, his concerns about environmental health. And the effect of pollutants. And he's done a lot of work in that area and says he wants to continue advocating for you know, removing pollutants and understanding the effect of those.
So let me just counter by saying, yeah. I agree with you, and that is a bright spot. But how does that counter with, say, Lee Zeldin as the head of the EPA?
Oh, right. Yes. So that's a very good question. How are these two going to balance out? That's a big question. Now, Lee Zeldin, the EPA is much smaller and less influential than HHS. I mean, they yes. like I think
or even Department of Interior, whatever.
Yeah. And so the amount of resources that Kennedy will have at his disposal if he becomes the secretary is going to dwarf anything that we see from the EPA.
Aaron.
When Trump was first elected in 2016, the first thing I did was watch season one of The Apprentice to get a sense of who he was and what his persona is. So this seems like season 16 of The Apprentice, where he's making unqualified people jump through enormous hoops in the hopes of gaining a little bit of his, to get on his good side. That's fine for a reality TV show. It's a very different thing when you're talking about running a government that controls a $30 trillion economy. So
it's just not as entertaining when it's not Cyndi Lauper.
Yeah, exactly. or Omarosa. So, but all kidding aside, as Marge pointed out, there are some interesting positives about RFK, about how he wants to end the revolving door and corporate representation amongst Big Pharma as, you know, major... part of the regulatory agency that governs this. So, you know, it's not that he's off the wall in all of the areas, but in terms of what he's likely to do in terms of actual health policy, it seems like the writing's kind of on the wall. And economists have a term for when people who are appointed to regulatory positions that are part of the industry that's being regulated. They call it regulatory capture. This seems to be, so that would be like nominating like Jamie Dimon to be the head of the Securities and Exchange Commission, the CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase. So this seems to be different. This is like functional capture where you're nominating somebody who has no experience to pretty much wreck the organization, run it into the ground, and then reshape it in a way that will make it fundamentally and functionally different. And the, you know, the cruel irony here is that people like RFK and then, you know, Matt Gaetz and all of these other cabinet appointees are going to use their position, if they're confirmed by the Senate, to further their own self-interests and not necessarily protect the public good. So the cruel irony is that these appointments, and if they get confirmed, are going to probably wreak the most havoc amongst the people who ended up voting for Trump.
As far as the economy goes, what impact could this have when you have, as March said, so much money coming into municipalities and throughout the country?
It's not a mystery that Trump wants to cut funding for social services to fund, to use that money for border security and tax cuts. So the implications for this are that, you know, HHS oversees Medicare and Medicaid. So those are two major spending programs that provide health care for the for low-income individuals and the elderly. The implications of this could be dramatic in terms of it forces people to pay more money out of pocket for health insurance, because if you're defunding government health organizations, then that's the way people get it. The economics of this, it's going to just place a greater financial burden and tighten the vise on the people who are most vulnerable and least able to afford, you know, health care and medical services.
I just wonder how many Scaramucci's, you know, RFK is going to last. And what I mean is, you know, if you remember, Anthony Scaramucci went into the first Trump administration for a very short period of time, 3 days, or maybe it was 5 days, I don't remember. But RFK disagrees with Trump on a number of issues, including
abortion,
exactly. And I think it would be very hard to argue that you're protecting the health of Americans while you take away, you know, subsidies for basic, you know, health insurance. So, you know, Medicare, Medicaid are under the Health and Human Services Department, as is a lot of other social services funding. And I just wonder if he's going to push back and how he would justify going along with the gutting of these programs while saying he's still for, you know, making America healthy again. That's his new mantra. So I just don't know how long he'll be there. That's a question that I have.
I think we have that question with many of these, these nominees, right? Go ahead.
I think there's another issue here, and that, say what you want about Trump, he is a pretty shrewd negotiator, and I'm not saying that ironically. These are his starting positions. So you nominate people that are just off the wall. They're, you know, loyalists for all intents and purposes. Trump's not an idiot, and I'm sure he's getting advice that these people might not get confirmed by the Senate. So if they don't get confirmed, anybody he nominates again is going to appear sane and competent. So this is just his starting position. If they get confirmed, great, he wins. If they don't get confirmed, I'm sure his team of advisors have second and third candidates in mind that could be perhaps, you know, more mainstream, but do as much damage as some of these other people could do.
So one more question that I'm going to ask, because I've been asking this all week, so let me ask it again, which is the you all know this by heart now. As I start to say it, your lips will move because you know what I'm going to say. But what we've heard all week from the administration is, well, the president has the mandate, and he has the right to have the cabinet that he wants.
There's a reason that we have Senate confirmation, right? And that is that these candidates for these appointments need to be able to get through the gauntlet and face the questioning. And now you have a president who's saying he wants recess appointments.
Right.
That is the power to make the appointments when the Senate is not there.
Send them away for 2 weeks. We'll put everybody in, and then you all come back. And
so my question is this Republican Senate going to just cave into this request, which would indicate that we have lost all checks and balances? Or are those voices in the Senate that are expressing that they want to do some questioning, are they going to prevail?
We also have four wonderful students from Siena College's Federal Reserve Challenge Course: Casey Owens, Jade O'Connell, Bobby Tuhig, and Ethan Tate. And in fact, Ethan, I know you wanted to jump in on the Kennedy nomination.
Yeah, sure. I think What's just interesting to me watching all of this is it seems like we've kind of entered into a political climate in recent years where things are so polarized on either side that we've kind of lost merit-based appointments to history, it feels like. And so it feels like all these appointments are coming in a time where the party is just using it as a tool for the party's goals rather than that merit-based appointment. And I think that can be seen across multiple agencies, and so it's disappointing to see it even in this case.
I mean, I know, you try to be careful and not to be overtly political when you talk about these things, but, you know, I think you're absolutely right. There was a time when you picked people who were, I don't know, qualified for the jobs, and you would think, oh well, maybe they did this and they did that, but they also have this policy and they have that policy, and this is, you know, and instead of just a direct anti, and certainly both March and Malia did underline and underscore some of the positive things that RFK Jr. has done throughout his career. However, for this job, you do wonder, and also, and then it goes down the line to Matt Gaetz and others who have been named. So, yeah, it's a great point of people who actually, you know, going out and finding the best and the brightest to come in. Let's go to a couple of letters. Holly writes to us and says, "Friends, these nominees are across the board ridiculous. And I believe Trump knows this. I suggest turning the analysis around and seeing these nominations as a cynical and thinly veiled loyalty test." It's just basically what Ethan was just saying. "Will he make note of Republicans who object and set his attack dogs on them?" I will say, in the days immediately following some of the more controversial nominations, that I was surprised that a lot of the press coverage was on the Republicans who spoke out as opposed to the Democrats. Yeah, this is a loyalty test, right?
But Republicans have spoken out against Trump before, and then a couple days later, a couple weeks later, immediately fall in line, yeah, and, you know, kiss the ring.
Right.
Well, I think the listener makes a very good point, I'm an analyst. I can't help getting into sort of the details, but you step back for a moment and you think, yeah, that's what he's trying to achieve here. I think it's pretty clear.
"Does anyone," asks Robert, "consider that just maybe Matt Gaetz and RFK are nothing more than a smokescreen for the Trump transition team? It wouldn't be the first time." To which I would say, let us talk about Secretary Ben Carson and Secretary Betsy DeVos, ...
It probably is a smokescreen. We don't know what's going on behind the scenes. I kind of look at the whole process and Trump's philosophy here as, people call it percussive maintenance. Do you guys know what that is? That's when you start hitting a mechanical device that isn't working, and sometimes it works better. It's also called mechanical agitation or destructive repair. I mean, there are a lot of people in the country right now who believe that we need to break things to fix them, and that's a very scary thing.
That was March Gallagher on the Roundtable panel on Friday, November 15th. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are available online at wamc.org/roundtable. This has been this week's Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds. Thank you for listening.